Members of the Elections Committee will come to order. Welcome. We don't have a quorum yet, but we only need one more member until we do. And we do have some procedural items to take care of that do require a quorum. So I appreciate you all here. For members and for staff who are down here, please help yourself. Representative Joanne Ward, who was before us at our last hearing, made good on, I don't know if it was a promise, but the shameless shaming that Representative O'Driscoll applied to her for being a first-term member with her first bill not bringing any food. While that's an unevenly applied rule or custom,
it is a good one.
He sort of shamelessly guilted her into bringing food, and she did. She's not here today, even though we are going to reconsider her bill, and I'll explain that in a minute. It's unrelated to the food, I assure you. But she brought some clementines and some fancy chocolates, and they're delicious, so help yourself. We do have a quorum now, members, so... If the Vice Chair cares to move approval of the minutes of January 29th.
Mr. Chair, I move approval of January 29th meeting minutes.
Thank you, Representative Halverson. All in favor of approving the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Minutes are approved. The next thing we have to do, as I mentioned, pertaining to Representative Ward's bill, is we need to quickly move to reconsider it so that we can send it to a different committee. We had sent it erroneously to the General Register, not knowing that Representative Dill of the Environment and Natural Resources Committee wants to see it. So I am going to, and for newer members, that's two votes, basically. We have to vote on whether to reconsider it and then vote on the new motion to send it to the new committee. As you remember, it was not a controversial bill. So I'm going to move that this committee reconsider House File 141. Is there any discussion on that motion, the motion to consider? Seeing none, all in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. We now have House File 141 before us, and I will restate the earlier motion, and I will move that House File 141 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. Is there any discussion on that motion? Seeing none, all in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The bill is on its way to Representative Dill's committee. I want to pick up where we left off last time with House File 136, which is Representative Hansen's bill. And members, just so you know, the sort of culture that we are trying to foster here is really getting the work done in the committee where we possibly can. It's not always possible to do every last thing in the committee, especially where a bill has multiple committee stops. But to the extent possible and practical, if it's within our purview or our jurisdiction, we should really get it right and get as much agreement as we can, obviously, before it goes out. And so that's the reason why we held that over. And I think we're going to be in the habit of doing that where it's practical so that we can get it right. Representative O'Driscoll.
The pages have read my mind. Couldn't hear you. All of a sudden, we could start hearing you much better when we got the sound on. So.
Oh, okay. So the sound wasn't on. All right. Thank you. So I'll just repeat it just for the record. We're going to take up Representative Hansen's bill, which we had last time, and there were some lingering questions about drafting and wording. So we're going to get to his bill, hopefully act on it today, and have a good discussion about a couple of amendments. But I just wanted to say for the record that we're really going to make an effort to get things right in this committee. It's not always practical, and sometimes later in the session there will be time constraints where we have to sort of move bills along. But we really want to minimize the instances where we do that. And if it's elections related, and we are the elections committee, we're not going to leave it to some other non-elections committee to fix perceived or actual problems with bills. So that's going to be kind of the standard here, we hope. So with that, Representative Hansen, do you want to pick up kind of where you left off? I know we have a couple amendments to entertain, but you want to tell us what's happened between the last committee hearing and this hearing, and just remind folks about your bill.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Chair, and members of the committee and in the audience, House File 136 was brought before the committee last time, and we did make a change to it, and that was a technical correction, the A1 amendment, which is in the packets and I think was at the desk. So the A1 amendment, which had some corresponding language cross-referencing with judicial elections, was passed at the last committee. So 136 already includes the A1 amendment. House File 136, and Mr. Chair, please excuse, I have a bit of a cold, so if people are having a hard time hearing me, I'll try to be clearer. House File 136 is a is a bill that provides for public disclosure. It makes county commissioners and members of the judicial branch, the judges and justices, public officials. And what that does by making them public officials is it means that they would have to fill out the same conflict of interest forms that we have to as members of the legislature, and that the gift ban would also apply to them. If you look on the House File 136, you will see a list of all the folks that are public officials by statute, many of them elected, some of them appointed, some of them members of boards and commissions, and some of them are boards like watershed districts that are appointed with taxing authority. My purpose for doing this, and this is the third legislative session, I believe, that I have introduced this bill, is to bring consistency to elected officials. County commissioners have a lot of land use authority. They are the primary focus where we delegate a lot of responsibility and authority to at the county level, and that the judges, the district court judges, appellate court judges, and the Supreme Court justices are the third branch of government that also stand for election. So having consistency for those elected officials, I feel, is important. The A4 amendment is where we left off discussion at the last meeting, where there in the metro area, there are some county commissioners that have to fill out this already, and rather than doing that, having them file with both the county and with the campaign finance board, what the A4 amendment does is eliminates that duplication. There has been some disagreement between the campaign finance board and our staff as to what is needed for this purpose. I would like to go forward with the A4 amendment in order to follow up on what we said last time to remove that duplication with county commissioners.
Representative Hansen, I just want to make sure that we have the amendment properly before us, so I will move the A4 amendment so that it's before the committee for proper consideration. So as I understand it, what you want to do and what some other members here have raised last time is you want to make sure that metro, some or all or most metro area county commissioners don't have to do what you're intending to do twice. That is, if they already have a requirement to do this, you don't want to have them to fill out two sets of documents or paper. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. So I'm wondering if I could just, I know that there are, there's been some talk about how to accomplish this, and I just want to make sure if I could, Mr. Gehring, if your voice is up to it, could you just explain for us how and why you think, or maybe just that you think, that A4 accomplishes that goal?
So, Mr. Chair and members, the A4 amendment amends the existing subdivision of statute that provides that local officials file their statements of economic interest with their political subdivision rather than with the board. And what the amendment changes is that it provides that local officials don't include county commissioners. So basically what it does is exempt county commissioners from the requirement that they file with their local subdivision instead of the board.
Right. And Representative Hansen, you're satisfied with that analysis, that this would do what at least you're intending to do?
That is, I am satisfied with Mr. Gehring's explanation.
And can I ask, Representative Hansen, have you heard from any, you don't have to name names, but have you heard from local county commissioners who, I mean, they obviously, I would imagine, agree with this approach, but have you heard about them as to particular language or intent here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have not, in the interim, heard on this particular provision. I have heard anecdotally that prior to that, that when the county commissioners in the metro area have filed these reports at the county level, that they didn't feel that there were that many people looking at them. But in the interim, since the committee on this particular provision, I have not had specific. I've met with the county representatives, and I think this is, and we could ask them if they're okay with this, but I think we were clear at the last meeting.
Okay. I'm wondering, is there anyone here from the public who's here to testify on this amendment, this particular amendment? Anyone from the counties or anyone else? You don't have to, but okay. Any discussion on the A4 amendment from members? Any discussion? Okay. Seeing none, then, I'll call for a vote on the A4 amendment. All in favor of adopting the A4 amendment, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. members will go on to the A2 amendment. I believe that's Representative Erdahl.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move the A2 amendment.
Okay, Representative Erdahl moves the A2 amendment. You want to just describe or discuss the amendment? Representative Erdahl.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Hansen, county commissioners and other office seekers choose to run for office with certain expectations and guidelines by which they are expected to abide. Rules of the game, if you will. Currently, they do not have to file economic disclosure statements. This is not a bad thing. And I commend Representative Hansen for bringing this forward. In other words, it's not a bad bill. My problem is that some public officials elected to office may have made the decision to run in light of the provision that they don't have to disclose economic items. It is not fair to change the rules in the middle of the game, or in this case, in the middle of the term. I ask that we move this change in requirements to their next election so that those affected can decide whether or not to run based on these changes. In basic terms, defining county commissioners as public officials, for example, would make all county commissioners subject to filing economic interest statements, the gift ban, and conflict of interest provisions under 10A. Keep this in mind. All local municipal officials are already subject to their own version of the gift ban and conflict of interest provisions contained in Chapter 471. MS 471.87 prohibits commissioners from taking part in a sale, lease, or contract in their official capacity that would provide them a personal financial benefit. MS 471.895 prohibits county commissioners from accepting gifts from persons who could financially benefit from matters under the authority of the board. So again, even if we delay House File 136 until 2014, which the amendment asks for, county commissioners will still be subject to this local version of the gift ban and conflict of interest procedures. That means the only provision commissioners won't need to abide by until 2014 is filing the economic disclosure statements. Under this amendment, about half the commissioners in the state would come into compliance with the provision in 2014. The other half, those just elected in 2012, would start filing in 2016. So, Representative Hansen, eventually you would get what you're after with this bill. I think you would maybe have a better chance in final passage if you accepted this amendment. It just would take a little bit longer.
Before I just want to get Representative Hansen's reaction, then I'll go to Representative Winkler. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the counties, Association of Counties, has brought this concern to me as well. I have pondered it. I think that what we're talking about here is disclosure in the public interest, and that when we look at what has occurred already, particularly with the Soil and Water Conservation District supervisors, that occurred in the method that this bill would propose, where it would happen prior to the election. It would give the campaign finance board time to implement this year prior to the election so that the implementation would not be occurring at the same time as the elections. We had testimony from the campaign finance board that this would increase the cost rather than having it done in the off year. I understand where Representative Erdahl is coming from. I would like to hear some input from the committee on this because I think it would be desirable to have bipartisan support. However, I also think that there is a benefit for the public in having elected county commissioners fill out the same forms that we have. I don't think it's that big of an onerous task to bring them into the same amount of sunshine that we have as elected officials. And I have not had an individual county commissioner come to me and say, I wouldn't have run if I'd known I'd had to fill out an economic interest form. And I don't know of any specific one that has raised that concern. I'm hearing general concerns that this may happen. So I'd like to hear the debate a little bit. I would like to move the bill forward. But we have had testimony that the amendment would increase the cost for implementation for the campaign finance board.
Okay. Thanks, Representative Hansen. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen, it seems to me there are two moving parts in this amendment. The first is the effective date, and the second is the concept that you don't have to fill it out unless you're elected after the requirement goes into effect. So if we struck the enactment date, or the effective date, and simply said that it applies to public officials elected to terms after the effective date of this, on or after the effective date of your bill, would you run then into the same financial concern?
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, and I have thought about this because I do have some concern that having the de facto implementation date of August 1st may be a short time period after whenever this passes, you know, and I'm not sure if it's going to pass individually or part of a larger bill at the end of session, which then could have a 2-month or 3-month implementation date. So I am open to having the effective date be January 1st, which would, my understanding of that particular portion, would give the Campaign Finance Board longer time for education and compliance to bring them into the loop by having it done on January 1st. If that's, and maybe I'd ask Mr. Gehring if that's what would happen if it was that date without having it apply to the new terms.
Mr. Gehring, do you care to comment on that?
Mr. Chair, I think Representative Hansen is correct. So if you delay the effective date to January 1st, it would give the board more time to sort of process the documents. And I don't know, maybe Mr. Sigerson is here. He might be able to comment on that. But I think his general description is correct.
Okay. Representative Winkler?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I guess I'd be interested in that testimony.
Mr. Sigerson here. Do you mind, Mr. Sigerson? We'd like to hear from you. Just state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Jeff Sigerson. I'm the Assistant Director of the Campaign Finance Board. Certainly, with the delay in implementation, we would work with the various county associations with whatever would be appropriate with the entities for the judicial candidates, or judges, I should say, to work in providing education to those entities so it's not quite as condensed in terms of giving that information.
And Mr. Sigerson, I'm still mindful of what you said the last hearing, which is, and I think it's a good lesson for this committee and others, you know, we have been piling additional responsibilities on your agency for a while without any funding increase, and so that's just a free advertisement for what will happen in Representative Murphy's committee, but we are mindful of that. I think everyone on the committee is, that there is some, even if it's negligible, even if it's small, there's an additional, you know, pressure on resources. We understand that. Representative? Yeah.
I just want to follow up on that.
Okay, Representative Erdahl, and then we'll go down the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Severson, do you have an estimate if my amendment were to pass, how much additional cost that would create?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl, I'm not sure that would, in fact, increase the overall cost. The estimate that I provided to the committee last time was $8,600 for the first year and then approximately $5,500 for every successive year, because we believe that it would be following, or assumed, it would be following the Soil and Water District conservation provisions, which was we brought everybody in at once. And so there was a higher upfront cost to contact every Soil and Water District commissioner, or member, I should say, representative. And going down that path, then we assume that there would be a higher upfront cost to contact all county commissioners and judges at the same time.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Severson, so it may not increase cost.
Mr. Sears.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl, I believe, in fact, the cost would be about the same. It would be, again, there wouldn't be as much in the first year, but there would probably be somewhat higher in successive years. But the cost would be approximately the same, I believe.
Representative Johnson.
I'm just wondering, instead of having county, Mr. Chair, instead of having county commissioners talk to you, did you actually go talk to any county commissioners about this? Personally, I have. I've talked to a number of county commissioners. They don't have a problem with the concept. The problem they have is it changing it in midstream. The ones I talked to have no problem signing it. But there again, changing it in midstream, changing is a change that was unpredicted. And some county commissioners might resign, and then we're having special elections because of this. The other issue is, sounds like the problems you're having is requiring this is for county commissioner districts that have a large number of people. We have county commissioner districts ranging from over 100,000 people down to under 3,000 people per district. In those smaller districts, they know who these people are. They know what they do. There's no need for really to have this extra work. Would be better off picking a number, because we just got done with redistricting. We know how many people these commissioner districts have. Picking a number, if they're over a certain size at that point, bring them into the system where the people don't know them as well.
Representative Hansen, care to comment? Yeah,
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think there's an importance in terms of all county commissioners have the same authority, regardless of the county, the size of the county, or the size of the people that they, or the districts that they represent. There's 87 counties. So a land use decision in a county with 5,000 people and a vote in a 5,000 people district or county is the same thing as a vote in Dakota County, where there may be 200 or 300,000 voters. So I understand that argument, but I believe that there's a value in having consistency and everybody on the same playing field. The issue with people not knowing, and again, I find it interesting if a county commissioner would resign their office rather than fill out an economic disclosure form. I just find that curious, that that would be enough of a deterrent that they would give up their oath of office and the people they represent rather than fill out the same forms that we have to do, which really, and let's be clear about what those are, they're listing assets, land, whether they're involved in parimutuel gaming, whether they have assets in particular over 1,500. It doesn't say how much, it just says what those funds are, which folks have had to fill out. So I do know that when the soil and water supervisors came on board, there was one county where all five supervisors resigned rather than fill out the form. I find that curious. I think there's a good government perspective here of bringing this in. I do want to comment, and I would stand corrected based on the earlier testimony, because what I thought I heard 2 days ago was that there was an increased cost for delay. I think that's what I heard, even though we're talking about a couple thousand dollars. I do know that when the Campaign Finance Board brought in the Soil and Water Conservation Districts and the WMOs and WDs, one of the difficulties was even finding, particularly the WMOs and the WDs, members. It was very difficult to track them down because even the Board of Water and Soil Resources didn't have a list of some of those folks. I think with the Association of Minnesota Counties, they have a list. It'll be easier, and I would support what Representative Winkler had proposed of having the effective date January 1st, 2014, because you could have the education of bringing them all in, and it would take time, and then they would be done before the Campaign Finance Board begins the next round of elections. I think what I had heard and what I've heard anecdotally is when you bring in implementation of a new group at the same time you're running the election changes with the candidates, that adds complexity and difficulty potentially versus bringing people in. In addition, because we've just gone through redistricting, we have some people who have two-year terms and some people who have four-year terms. So if Mr. Representative Erdahl's amendment as it's written, you would not have implementation, full implementation, until 2016 for half of the county commissioners. So again, you'd have a difference of treating them all the same, even within a local county. Finally, on the issue of talking with county commissioners and bringing up the issue, like I said at the beginning, I have introduced this bill 3 sessions. It was introduced last time, and it's been out there in public. I've had the counties have been aware because it's been introduced before. The judges have been aware because it's been introduced before. Now, it seems to have attracted more attention now that I'm in the majority than when I was in the minority. But I think that it is important to bring in consistency, to have public disclosure, again, across the board for elected officials. And as I mentioned, I would support delaying the effective date to January 1st, 2014.
Let's hear from Representative O'Driscoll. I have a thought on that, Representative Hansen. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if maybe Mr. Green could help us out with this question, and depending upon how he answers it, I may or may not have some follow-up. I'm very familiar with municipal government, where if a member of the city council or mayor resigns, there's the option to be able to have a special election or an appointment. Does that flexibility exist at the county board level?
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I believe that's true, that counties can individually choose how they want to fill vacancies in their offices. So some counties might do the elected and special election process, and others might do an appointment process.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, the reason I asked for that clarification is we're strictly talking about those being elected to office. Yeah. We may also want to put in as appointed to such office as well. That way we're getting more transparency, which I think is what our ultimate goal is here.
Okay. Anyone else with an immediate comment? Okay. Representative Winkler, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, having had a total of 5 minutes now to think about this, it does seem to me that gathering more flies around this by sweetening it a little bit with this amendment might be not a bad idea. And we are ending up capturing everybody eventually. And we're on that path, and you're fixing this problem. So in the spirit of having a stronger show of support from the committee, that doesn't seem like a bad idea to me. It doesn't seem like we're giving up too much, but just throwing out my comment for you.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler and Representative Erdahl, that's why I went halfway. I mean, I think that delaying it provides the Campaign Finance Board with the ability to work with education to bring people into compliance. I do think Mr. Sigurdsson has an answer to Representative O'Driscoll's question specifically on if someone was appointed to a county board position that they would be covered.
Mr. Chairman, Representative
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Because of the definition of public official, which is the, if you look at the bill, lines 26 and 27 are adding county commissioners by the fact that they've taken the oath of office, whether they are elected or appointed. Once they become a county commissioner, they are covered under the definition of public officials, so that they would already be.
Okay. Any other comments on the A2 amendment, members? Any other comments? Anyone from the public who wishes to testify on the A2 amendment? Okay, if not, then, members, I think we're ready to vote. All in favor of the A2 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. If there are no other amendments, and I don't think there are, I think we're ready to vote on the bill itself. Any other last comments from members of the committee or the public on the overall bill, House File 136? Seeing none, all in favor, I'll renew my motion then, that House File 136 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. That's the motion. All in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion is adopted. Thank you, Representative Hansen.
Thank you.
We're going to hear now from Representative Simon on his bill, and I'll let you go ahead and move your bill and introduce
you.
It to us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will move that House File 193 be recommended to pass and refer to. I have to think about that now.
Sorry. We believe that it would go to the general register.
Okay. Let me restate the motion. I will move that House File 193 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register.
Representative Simon?
Well, thank you, members. I think this is a potentially important moment in the history of Minnesota elections. I think with this bill we have the opportunity to move forward to a system that rewards instead of punishes or accuses voters. And I say that on this non-excuses or no-excuses voter absentee voting bill because I think we have to acknowledge that this already goes on, no-excuses absentee voting. Right now, as you know, under Minnesota law, voters have to essentially swear an oath that they will be out of their precinct during the day of the election. And I think we all know, as a practical matter, practical reality, that very often voters, people we know and like and trust and work around, probably tell a little fib sometimes when they check that box. Sometimes they answer truthfully, but then circumstances change and they really are going to be in the precinct. But the statistic that I always found interesting, and I contacted this jurisdiction to make sure that my facts were straight, and they were, in the year 2008, in the city of Edina, about a quarter of the voters voted by absentee. Now, I have a hard time believing that they were all on a business trip that day. They probably weren't. What probably happened, I'm guessing, is that several people, as a matter of convenience, filled out the form and voted by absentee either because they were too busy or they wanted to avoid the hassle or some other reason of personal convenience. But the fact is we have no one who's the absence police out there who is questioning and following up on and doing oversight on whether someone really truthfully is out of the precinct for the day. So my point of view is that we shouldn't make lawbreakers out of the folks who, for reasons of convenience or otherwise, choose to vote absentee. As long as we have integrity protections in place, I think it's important that we make voting reasonably convenient for increasingly busy people. So that's what this does. I should point out that this is just one of two flavors, you might say, that early voting come in. One is a straight-up early voting period, where you have some period of time, maybe it's a week, maybe it's two, maybe it's three, before the election day on which regular voting, just like we all do when we go to a polling place, can happen. And I think in your packets, members, you'll see a map, which I found very helpful and revealing and interesting, of what other states do. And you'll see on that map, and it should be in color for those of you who have it, that there are 32 states around the country that have early voting of some kind. And on your sheet, and tell me if you don't have it somehow in your packets, do you all have that sheet? On that sheet, you'll see there are 32 states, either the green or the blue states, that have early voting. There are some large group of those that have both early voting and no excuses absentee, including every state that surrounds Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Wisconsin. And I would point out in terms of early voting, straight up early voting, which this bill is not, but in terms of that, there are states that run the gamut in terms of their ideological bent. You have states that are stereotypically more progressive that have embraced that concept, and states that are stereotypically far more conservative that embrace that concept. So you have a real diversity of opinion or political cultures as well. But there's only one state, New Jersey, as you'll see on your graphic, that has only no excuses absentee and not early voting. Only one. So ideally, I would be the first to tell you that ideally, we should have both in Minnesota, an early voting period like all of our surrounding states and like 32 states already have, and we should have no excuses absentee voting. But I understand that in this political climate and with the requirement that we pass bipartisan legislation, that may not always be possible, may not be possible this year. We don't know. We don't have before us an early voting bill. So I thought it best to focus on the area where I think we have the most chance for some bipartisan support, and that is no excuses absentee voting. So I think that this bill would put us in the 21st century, make us acknowledge how the real world works when it comes to electioneering and voting, and it would put us in sync with most other states in the United States. I passed out for your review, in case you once knew and forgot or never knew, two important documents that you can get upstairs here in this building at the Secretary of State's office, and I did before the hearing. I just went by the public area and grabbed a fistful of both of these. One is the voter registration application, which is only indirectly a part of this bill, and the other is the Minnesota absentee ballot application. I suspect that as we're discussing amendments and discussing any concerns that might arise, we're going to be going back to at least the absentee ballot application so that we can see how this actually works in the real world and has worked for quite some time. So with that, members, it's a pretty straightforward bill. Before we get into the technical matters and sort of a line-by-line, section-by-section, which I think we can and should do, I think we should hear from a number of the other testifiers who want to speak in broader terms about the merits of the underlying policy. So, Madam Chair, at your discretion, I don't know if you care to have up next. But
Very good. I think that that suggestion is very good because I'm sure that these testifiers will be able to speak to a number of the questions that might be percolating in members' minds. So with that, I would invite the first testifier, Beth Fraser, from the Office of Secretary of State to come down if she's available.
Madam Chair, if I might.
Yeah, Representative Simon.
If we could wait on Ms. Fraser because she'll be the one to walk us through the more technical aspects of the bill. I should have mentioned maybe any of the others. Sure. And I know that Mr. Kaiser is on his way. He's not here yet. So other than Mr. Kaiser and Ms. Fraser, let's go with some of the other testifiers at your discretion.
Very good. Very good. Is Joe Mansky from Ramsey County Elections available? Welcome to the committee. Would you state your name for the record, please?
Thanks, Madam Chair. I am Joe Mansky from the Ramsey County Election Office. And in case you did not know this, the proposal for people to vote with an absentee ballot without a reason is not a revolutionary concept. In fact, we have done this in the past. For those of you who do not know this, the legislature established something called the Board of Government Innovation in the early 90s. And as a part of that, the Ramsey County Board applied to this body for a waiver from the provision to state a reason to vote absentee, which they were granted by this board. And if you have my handout, which I think is in your packets, it's fairly clear what happens when you remove the requirement to state a reason. That basically comparing presidential elections are the rate at which our residents cast absentee ballots increased by over 50%. And when the ability to do this was taken away, it went down by nearly the same amount. But I think what is fairly clear here is that this is something that the voters want to do and that when made available, they will in fact do this. I also put on this handout our absentee voting numbers from this last election in November. And I think what you're seeing there is that, at least in Ramsey County, our absentee voting is primarily a suburban phenomenon, that 60% of all of our absentees are cast in the suburbs. Only about 40% are cast in St. Paul. In a survey that we did when we were doing the no-excuse absentee voting in the 90s, we also found demographically that about 40% of the people taking advantage of that were elderly people, which I guess would not surprise too many people here. And as our population is getting older, there clearly is more interest in people being able to vote on a day other than Election Day. And I guess the last thing that I'll mention to you that, as Representative Simon indicated, no-excuse absentee voting is similar to, but not exactly, early voting. This process, the bill that is in front of you, still requires you to fill out the certificate on the envelopes and put your ballot into an envelope, and you don't actually, as a voter, put your ballot into the ballot box. You actually place it into another box that we will process at a later time. Doing that last year cost us about $7.28 per voter. Our preference, and again, this would be a different bill than the one before you, our preference, to be honest with you, is for voters who come into our office to put their ballot directly into a ballot box, which is better for them because we treat them exactly the same way we would treat a voter at the polling place, with the same protections, and it only costs us $3.80 a voter to do that, so about half the cost. Put your ballot directly into a ballot box. Right now, at least going back the last three state general elections here in Ramsey County, about a third of our absentee traffic has been walk-up, which is they either come to our office or one of our city offices. The other two-thirds are coming in through the mail. And, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions or just let it go at that.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Manske, just a question. How many absentee ballots, do you know how many absentee ballots were turned down because of an invalid response?
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, our rejection rate has been going down since 08. This year we rejected fewer than 2% of all the absentees that were sent to us.
Thank you.
Representative, thank you. Additional questions for this witness? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony, Mr. Manske. Next on the list, looks like Jeff Narabrook from the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. Welcome to the committee. Would you please state your name for the record?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jeff Narabrook from the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. We're a statewide association of 2,000 nonprofits, many of which encourage civic engagement and conduct nonpartisan voter engagement activities, voter registration, voter education, things like that. We also belong to the Nonpartisan Voting Rights Coalition, which is a group of organizations working on increasing civic participation through policy and in practice out in the field. We support allowing citizens to vote absentee without requiring a reason. It accommodates citizens who balance multiple demands on their time. And the state benefits from a system we believe that maximizes participation, and allowing voters to freely vote absentee without asking why is in line with that interest. For similar reasons, we ask that the committee do consider in-person early voting in addition to no-excuse absentee. Like absentee, early voting allows citizens to decide how and when to vote. It would be cheaper, as we just heard from Mr. Manske, per vote than absentee ballots for counties to administer. It preserves the trappings of Election Day, kind of the social, the common space and time for people to come together and vote. And it doesn't require finding a registered voter or notary as a witness, as absentee ballots do. Locating an eligible witness can be a challenge for some absentee voters who are new to Minnesota, if they live alone or don't live with other registered voters. Also, from a nonprofit organization perspective, early voting would be a welcome tool for engaging the community in increasing civic participation. So, for example, if you operated a homeless shelter, domestic violence shelter, a residential treatment facility, any kind of residential site, having more days and opportunities to help residents actually physically get out and vote would really be invaluable. So no-excuse absentee voting is a welcome change, but we believe a combined no-excuse absentee and early voting system provides the most value for voters, for the counties, and would probably go farthest in addressing things like long lines on Election Day. So we hope this is just the start of discussing ways to improve our election system. I thank you for your time.
Thanks, Mr. Narabrook. Are there questions for this testifier today? Seeing none, I thank you for your comments.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't think Mr. Kaiser is here yet, but I think we should proceed then. I'd ask if Ms. Fraser could join me here, and we can march through the more technical aspects of the bill, which I think will tee up one or more of the amendments here.
Very good. Thank you. I see Ms. Fraser approaching. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Fraser. Could you state your name for the record?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members. Beth Fraser with the Office of the Secretary of State. So the bill in front of you, Madam Chair and members, basically does two things. It removes the requirement that absentee voters provide an excuse to vote by absentee ballot, and it makes changes to a procedure in place for voters who expect to be out of the precinct or otherwise wanting to vote by absentee ballot on a regular or ongoing basis. The first section, it removes the requirement for a reason to vote absentee ballot. So it basically says any eligible voter may vote by absentee ballot. The second section relates to people applying for permanent or ongoing absentee ballot status and removes the requirement that they provide a reason. And in paragraph E of that section on 2.32, it changes the process from voters receiving an application to voters receiving an actual ballot. I think the current process doesn't serve voters very well and is somewhat confusing because voters fill out an application, and then in return for filling out an application in the mail, they get an application, which is somewhat confusing because I think they thought they were signing up to get a ballot for each election because they've sworn that they believe they'll be unable to go to the polling place and have indicated that they want to vote by absentee ballot on an ongoing basis. So this kind of straightens that procedure out. It changes it so that these voters are receiving an actual ballot instead of an application before each election. Subdivision 6 is one of the two subdivisions in current law that allow voters to receive applications or ballots on an ongoing basis. It says that these ballots from now on must be sent by non-forwardable mail, and that's to ensure that the voter hasn't moved. Of course, if somebody has moved, we don't want to send them a ballot because they may now live in a different precinct. So this requires that ballots be non-forwardable, so if the person has moved, it will be returned to the local election official. Section 4 removes the requirement that the applications be sent. Section 5 provides procedures for the transition from the current process to the new process, requiring county auditors to mail an explanation of changes to the people who have currently signed up for this status. There are about 8,100 voters in Minnesota who currently have status as a permanent or ongoing absentee voter. So it says that county auditors have to mail an explanation of the changes to them, have them fill out an application so that from now on they will receive a ballot for each election. And then Section 6 repeals the other section of law that currently allows voters to receive applications on an ongoing basis. And that is the bill as introduced.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Representative Simon.
I think what would be helpful at this point, if I might recommend, mm-hmm. I think there's some technical issues that needed to be resolved that I think the A1 amendment does hopefully resolve. I understand, that's right, there was a change to the A1, wasn't there? What's the new, it's A5, A5 now. Right, okay, now it's the A5. So I guess it would be the A5 amendment. That's right, we can ditch the A1. So, and members, just so you understand in terms of deadlines, the A1 amendment, which was submitted within the deadline, is substantively not changed, but there were some drafting errors or things that needed to be improved, which were of a technical nature, so that's why the A5. And so in keeping with our culture of reasonable leeway, I think you'll find that, you know, the public is well informed about the substance here. It's just a matter of the technical material. And I'm wondering, Madam Chair, if I could have Ms. Fraser just explain what the A5 amendment does.
Yes, Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. To go through the A5 amendment, the first section of this amendment, which begins on 1.4, this is basically the other section of law that currently allows voters to receive applications on an ongoing basis. And when we were originally drafting the bill, we decided to consolidate these two sections of law into one section. And the other section of law had a lot more detail in it as to when somebody's status ended. And so at first it made sense to keep that section and delete this section. But what we realized is that this section of law, as you'll see on 1.19, provides rulemaking authority. And we did not want to repeal the rulemaking authority because there are rules that go with this authority. And so we decided to switch it and now are repeal. So we moved the language from the other section of law to this section of law and are switching which of the two subdivisions we're repealing. That's basically what this does. The other change from current law to this amendment is in that section is 116 and 117. And 117 in particular. Right now, current law says that a voter's permanent status ends if the voter is challenged, and it only names two of the reasons that a voter could be challenged, and or inactive, and it only names one of the reasons that a voter could become inactive. This is a change that should be made to current law, and so it's being made in this bill, so that if a voter is challenged or inactive for any reason, it would stop the process of sending them the ballot. Section 6 of this bill changes the time, of the amendment, changes the timing related to when absentee ballots can be finally processed and when they're considered final by election officials. Right now, voters have up until Friday at 5 before absentee ballots are considered final. If a voter before Friday at 5 decided that they had changed their mind, they could basically pull their ballot back and submit another ballot. This changes that deadline. After Friday at 5, election officials are allowed to mark the rosters that the person has voted, so they're no longer allowed to vote in person in the polling place or to cast another absentee ballot. They're allowed to open the envelopes and begin feeding them into the voting machines. This changes that deadline from Friday at 5 to Tuesday at 5, so basically gives them a week to do all of this processing. The election official from the city of Minneapolis told me just at the beginning of this hearing that they had looked and seen how many voters had changed their mind in 2012. Of the 15,000 absentee voters in the city of Minneapolis, one changed their mind and pulled their ballot back. In 2010, zero did. So this is not a frequent occurrence or something you need to worry much about, it would seem. Section 7 of the amendment does the same thing, changes the deadline. And the thinking behind that is that there will be many more ballots that need to be processed. And finalizing the process and taking the ballots out of the envelope that has the form on it and then out of the envelope that protects the voter secrecy and unfolding them and putting them into the machines is a very time-consuming process, and that with many more ballots, they'll need more time to do that work. The Section 8 of the amendment also changes that deadline and changes the timing or changes the way that the timing related to the notice to voters about changes to permanent and ongoing absentee ballot status, when that is. Instead of having a fixed date, it makes it a date that floats 60 days before the primary, so that if the primary were ever to change, it does not cause a problem with having a different date. 4.9 changes which of the two subdivisions we're repealing, and Section 11 makes this adds an effective date to the bill so that it's effective for the state primary in 2014 and thereafter.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, just to put a fine point on a couple of things that Ms. Fraser was talking about, this business about moving it back from 4 days to 7 days, there are two main reasons to do that. One is, of course, just administrative convenience. So just to repeat, and this is something I just got my head around fairly recently, is right now under the current system for absentee ballots, they all come in, they stream in over a course of days or even weeks, and they sit in a pile, and the election administrators can't do anything with them, can't start opening them and loading them into machines. They're not counted until election day. That never happens. But or at least, well, they're not tabulated. No human being knows what's in those, okay? They may be loaded into a machine, but no human being knows until Friday at 5 p.m. before the election. That's when they can start processing them. But what happens is it's chaos that last few days before the election, and frankly, it costs these local units of government a lot of money because they have to pay people in overtime to work on Saturday and Sunday, and that happens all over the place. It happens in my district. It happens in, I'm sure, almost every one of yours, if not all of your districts. And so if we're going to have, as Mr. Mansky seems to imply, and as seems natural and reasonable, if we're going to have a spike of whatever kind, a measurable spike, in the number of people voting absentee, do we really want to incur the extra overtime costs and continue with a date that's Friday at 5 p.m. rather than giving him a little bit of leeway to cope with the increased flow of absentee ballots. So that's really what that is about. And, you know, and whether it's, you know, 2 days or 3 days or 5 days, just an acknowledgement of the real world, which is that it takes real human beings time to open these up, well, verify them, open them up, feed them into a machine, and that can take a lot of time. In the case of Minneapolis, it's 15,000, but in all of our jurisdictions, it takes some time. So that's what that's about. And then I do want to point out, again, that we, because these are interwoven, interconnected parts in this committee, you know, I expect we'll be talking about the primary date in Minnesota, and we didn't want to foreclose any opportunities. So on line 4.7 of the A5 amendment, and afterwards you'll see that the date is pegged to 60 days prior to the date of the state primary, because we don't know when that'll be. Right now it's in August. Maybe it'll be another date. But we understand there are members of the committee and others outside this committee for whom that's an important discussion point, so we didn't want to foreclose that here. So that's what the amendment does.
Madam Chair, Fraser, if I could just clarify. Regardless of when absentee ballots are fed into the machine, they are not counted until the polls close, 8 p.m. on election night. Just like people come into the polling place at 7 a.m. and feed their ballot in the machine, we don't know how that person voted until 8 p.m. when the machine is, the key is turned and it prints off, here are the vote totals. So regardless of whether the ballots are fed into the machine 3 weeks ahead or the Tuesday before or the Friday before, we don't know how the people voted until 8 p.m. on election night.
Thanks for that clarification. Representative Simon?
If I may, Madam Chair, I know we've got other amendments here and we've got other issues, and I have to say it would be my preference that we not take a vote on this today. I think this is going to need more than one hearing, and we need a fresh engrossment, fresh version of the bill so that people can really look at this stuff. That would be my preference, Madam Chair. But I think the best way to go procedurally, is Mr. Kaiser here yet? No. Okay, he should be here any time. I think he said 1:30. But it would be my preference, before we get to other amendments, to put this amendment on, since it is an author's amendment. I understand there are substantive disagreements, and I promise all members of both parties that we will get to those and entertain amendments on those. So this isn't railroading anything, but I want to get it in the shape that I'd like it in as the author, so we can use that as the point from which to start. So that would be my request as we wait for Mr. Kaiser, and we will have a full airing of all the substantive issues in here, I'm sure.
Thank you, Representative Simon. Per your request, I could ask for members to vote on the A5 amendment now, and then I believe that there is a technical change that will be made after. Okay, very good. Any additional discussion of the A5 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion passes. Very good. And now that we've adopted that amendment, there is, I understand, a small technical change that needs to be made, and I can refer that to Mr. Gehring here to explain what that technical change would be.
So, Madam Chair and members, in light of adoption of the A5 amendment, there's just one small reference update that needs to happen in the bill itself. So on page 2, line 32 of the bill, there's a reference where subdivision 5 is stricken, and it's newly adopted as subdivision 6. That reference should be eliminated, so the oral amendment would be H2, line 32 of the bill, delete 6 and reinstate the stricken 5. That's just updating the bill itself to reflect the changes that were made in the A5 amendment.
Very good.
Chair?
Representative Simon.
I'm happy to make that oral amendment. So as Mr. Gehring said, and tell me if I'm doing it right or wrong, Mr. Gehring, I move that we reinstate the stricken language and get rid of 6. That's the amendment. I just want to make sure everyone has that.
Yes. Okay.
That would be my amendment.
That's your amendment. Very good. Any discussion on the oral amendment? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Very good. The motion passes. Very good. And looking at the time here, I wanted to invite, if he's here, Mr. Kent Kaiser to come to testify. If he looks like he's here. Very good. Thank you. Thanks, Ms. Frazier. Mr. Kaiser, welcome to the committee, and I hope you've caught your breath, and yeah. I know you were running to and from meetings, so if you would please state your name for the record.
Yeah, I'm Kent Kaiser, professor at Northwestern College in Roseville, and a
senior fellow at Center of the American Experiment in Minneapolis, and formerly was the Communications and Voter Outreach Director for the Secretary of State's Office under Secretaries Kiffmeyer and Ritchie.
Thank you very much. And did you want to introduce any information, Representative Simon? Otherwise, if you would like to speak to this House File 193, please.
I'm here to speak in favor of House File 193. I support Representative Simon's bill because I think the law as it's currently in place requiring excuses to obtain an absentee ballot is unenforced and unenforceable. I think that, you know, in my time in the Secretary of State's office, we had many inquiries about the excuses that were required for obtaining an absentee ballot, and basically would tell people that it was unenforced, because it's not as though if somebody requests an absentee ballot that we were actually going to go out and make sure that they had one of the excuses legitimately, and nobody was going to check up on them. And we always felt that, in fact, it could have dissuaded some people from actually voting because of the fact that we have so many law-abiding citizens in the state that they would want to follow the letter of the law, and it would turn out that perhaps they could have used an absentee ballot, but they would be so afraid to use one because of those excuses that they wouldn't, and then something might come up on election day and they wouldn't actually wind up voting. And we used to explain to them in very broad terms, for example, that one of the excuses is that you have to be out of your precinct on election day. And we'd ask people, well, are you sure you're not going to be out of your precinct at some point during the day? Because if you would be, then you would technically be within the law and be able to get an absentee ballot. And I think that we want to expand the opportunity for people to vote by absentee ballot to make it more convenient for them. I do know that there are some individuals and groups on the conservative side of my side, I suppose you'd say, who would disagree with me, but I think they actually disagree with other components of the absentee ballot process and not this part of it. And I think that we, again, want to expand the opportunities for people to participate in voting. And I also want to note that our absentee voting system, with this one small tweak, will be a big reform, and I think that it is superior to some suggestions that we should have early voting, and for a couple of reasons. One is that with absentee voting, you do get the opportunity to change your mind if you want to, because the votes aren't counted until election day or close to election day. And you can all remember probably in 2002 when Senator's plane crashed 10 days before an election, and we had many people who wanted to change their votes. And if we'd had early voting, we would have had pandemonium with people not being able to change their votes because their votes already would have been cast and counted. And I certainly wouldn't want to see a system where we coupled early voting with no excuse absentee voting either, because then we'd have two different kinds of people, some who could change their mind and some who couldn't. And this actually happens much more often than you'd think. It's not just in the case of, for example, 2002, but people get more information as it gets closer to election day and they change their mind. I've heard of people changing their mind 3 days in a row and going back in and getting an absentee ballot 3 days in a row because they got more information and want to change their mind. And the other thing is that I've heard some people say, well, an early voting system could be superior because when you mark your ballot, you can run it through a machine and it's counted just like on election day, and it'll kick it back out at you if you made a mistake. Well, you could use that machine for absentee voting too. Just have it check the ballot to make sure that people didn't make a mistake and kick it back out at them if they did without actually counting it yet, and just count it on election day. So I think for all kinds of reasons, we should have no excuse, absentee voting, and also that's superior to early voting.
Thank you, Mr. Kaiser. Are there questions for Mr. Kaiser at all? No. Thank you for your comments. Oh, I was going to just actually say I know a couple of very good law-abiding citizens who were in that very predicament of one was on call, one of whom was due to have a baby on Election Day several years ago and was feeling very conflicted about not having the right excuse, if you will, for being out of the precinct. The likelihood was there. Turned out she had the baby the day after the election. But
yeah, we took many calls like that over the years in the Secretary of State's office, and I always want to encourage people to vote.
Very good, very good. Well, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Representative Simon?
Well, Madam Chair, I think that probably concludes at least those who had contacted us in advance about wanting to testify. And so now that we put on the A5 amendment, I realize that what happens, as often happens in many committees with many bills, is that the other amendments that have come in were pegged to a different version of the bill. It's another reason why I think it's good that we, in my opinion, lay this over today, and so members have a chance to air out any differences or talk about some of these issues. But my suggestion, Madam Chair, is that we can start at least a discussion about the substance of those other amendments without formally introducing them. And if it's okay with the Chair, I would start with the A3 amendment, which I don't think we should introduce and formally vote on, but in part because it's now pegged to different language. But as I understand it, and I don't want to make whoever wants to own up to it or own it, is fine, or we can have a general discussion, but I think it's an important issue to discuss. That the proponent of this, or the author of this amendment, is basically saying that we should get rid of the place on the absentee ballot application where you can sort of say other. It's the catch-all. Because right now, and those of you who came a little bit later, you'll see that I handed out just a copy. I literally went to the Secretary of State's office before the hearing and grabbed a fistful of these. This is the actual Minnesota absentee ballot application. And you'll see on there in Section 5 on the front page, right now you can check it and say you either have a Minnesota-issued driver's license or ID card, or here are the last four digits of my Social Security, or you can say I don't have that. This would, as I read it, change that. It would get rid of the I don't have it box and say that if you don't have a driver's license or a Social Security number, there's the language that's in this amendment, that you would have to show any other identification number assigned to the applicant by the state, political subdivision of the state, or a unit of the federal government. I guess, and maybe I'm putting the cart before the horse, Madam Chair, because no one's kind of volunteered to take this on, but I guess my question to whomever would offer this would be, and it sounds like we have a couple takers, I guess my genuine question would be, what is this? Is this code for some particular kind of ID that people are looking for, or is this intended to be a new kind of catch-all provision for any other ID?
Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Simon, your comments about how the bill has had some substantive changes and a chance to step back and look at the amendments. I am the author of both the A2 and the A3 amendment. And at this point, what I'd like to do is have the opportunity to be able to step back and to review these and have a chance to discuss these when we're discussing other provisions of the bill, because there have been some substantive changes, and we may also have other amendments or other ideas and suggestions to shape this for bipartisanly supported bill out of the committee.
Madam Chair, if I may, I
appreciate that, and that's why we're not going to vote on this today, apparently. And we got to get it right, and we got to get the kind of support that we need, and that means different things for different members. The only thing I would point out that I didn't know, actually, until the Secretary of State's office told me, is that we didn't even apparently start asking for this stuff in Section 5 until, if I have it right, Ms. Fraser can correct me if I misunderstood, but we didn't start asking for all this until after the 2008 election. And the reason for asking for it was had nothing to do, or almost nothing to do, with verifying identity or eligibility. It had to do with making sure you could match a voter and their absentee ballot in a way other than a signature match. Because before, one of the big problems in the 2008 recount was putting our election judges and others in the position of being handwriting experts and determining whether what they signed on this ballot application was the same as the signature that appeared on their sealed absentee ballot. And so my understanding, and maybe Ms. Fraser can amplify this or explain or contradict if I got it wrong, is that we put these objective indicia in there. I mean, it could be anything. It could be your bank number PIN. It could be anything. It's not an identification or eligibility issue. It's some objective number that you can match up. It could be a barcode. It could be something. That's my understanding, but Ms. Fraser might be in a better position to say whether I got that right or not.
Ms. Fraser.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, that is right. Prior to 2010, there was no space for identification numbers when it came to absentee balloting, and it was introduced as a substitute for signature matching. And so we now ask people applying for an absentee ballot to provide their driver's license number or state ID number and the last four digits of their Social Security number if they have one. And then on the envelope, they are asked to provide one of those numbers so that the absentee ballot board can compare the numbers and ensure that the ballot was submitted by the same person who applied for it. And election judges have found it much easier to determine, and absentee ballots are accepted and rejected by pairs of election judges of different major political parties, they found it easier to agree upon whether there's a match when you're looking at numbers as opposed to whether the signatures match. And so that is the reason for those numbers, and that's the reason and the way that they're used. They are not verified other than comparing the application and the envelope. And the one thing that we found is that by giving voters choices right now with the driver's license or state ID and the last four of their Social Security number, is that giving those choices actually sometimes causes confusions. Voters call up and say, well, which number did I provide? I don't remember. And so I worry a little bit that in addition to concerns about voters who may not have one of these numbers, that it would actually cause more voter confusion and more phone calls about, well, what number did I provide? And more concern about that.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Representative Simon.
And the reason I picked up a fistful of this document as well, which mm-hmm. isn't just a photocopy, it's an actual, you know, sealable document. This is the voter registration application. And just to remind all ourselves, as I need pretty constant reminding, because it is easy to get confused. This is where, not the absentee ballot application, this is where a voter has to prove that they are who they say they are. So if you see in the bottom of this where it says for election judge official use only, this is where you either have to provide an ID with a current address, a photo ID with a utility bill, or the other category, which is the vouching and all the rest. So just so members don't think that someone could, who's never been registered before, could, under current law or under this bill, just kind of fill this out, put down whatever number, and suddenly they've never been registered and they're going to get an absentee ballot. That can't happen now. This bill wouldn't change that. I just want to make sure that's clear for the record. So when it comes to figuring out who's who and are they really who they say they are, that goes on in some other place beforehand. Nobody who is not registered to vote at all and hasn't been screened and filtered through all the databases could ever, under current law or later, just fill one of these out and suddenly just get an absentee ballot in the mail.
Representative,
right? Totally screw that one up. Go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, one of the big differences between the ID numbers provided on a voter registration application versus an absentee ballot application is that under federal and state law, when voters provide an ID number on the voter registration application, that number actually is verified against either the driver's license database or the Social Security Administration database. There is not a similar procedure in place for numbers provided on an absentee ballot application. Voters, whether they're pre-registered or not, are allowed to apply for an absentee ballot, but then the county or city looks to see whether they're registered, and if they're registered, sends them one set of materials, and if they're not registered, sends them a different set of materials that includes a voter registration application, and they need to show their witness not only their blank ballot to ensure that it arrived blank and not pre-filled out, but also need to show their witness their proof of residence as they would an election judge in the polling place, because they're basically doing same-day registration.
Madam Chair, just for a second. Okay, what I should have said then is that no one can actually have their vote counted unless they're registered. And that's the key distinction. So lest people think that they could just sort of get around the voter registration application process by filling this out, and then somehow their vote would be cast and counted, that's not going to happen. So, and this bill doesn't change that. It's easy to get confused, as I obviously just was.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the reasons that Representative Simon has articulated here, since we are looking at the process for absentee balloting, and by Ms. Frazier's own experience, people calling the office, what number did I give you? It only makes sense that we would look at this in depth as well, hand in glove with the other changes on here, and identify and take corrective action to preserve voters' voting integrity and system integrity. So, again, we will not be asking to move those amendments today. We want to get a chance to look at the bill as it's been amended, and as you said and suggested, a fresh engrossment of this, and we will be back to offer some suggestions to help make this, we believe will also be a bipartisanly supported bill.
Thank you. On that note, are there additional questions? We've got 10 minutes left. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Simon and Ms. Frazier didn't touch on this, but this language in the absentee ballot statute came about in a very similar process to the one that we should be pursuing today. And that is that we don't maybe have this much time this session, but Representative Kiffmeyer and I and Representative Simon, Representative Tom Emmer, Representative Mary Kiffmeyer, I guess I said her, Senator Ann Ress, Senator Chris Gerlach.
Senator Broad. Representative Laura Broad.
Representative Laura Broad, Senator Sieben. We all spent a lot of time together over at the Humphrey Institute responding to the lessons learned in the 2008 recount and going through everybody's list of suggestions of how we could improve the absentee ballot process. And what we did was color code every issue. If nobody disagreed with it was green and it was in the bill. If somebody strongly disagreed and would never support a bill with that in there, it was a red issue and it never made it into the bill. And the and then if people were a little unsure, maybe not too excited about it, it was tagged yellow for later discussion. And so this ID number discussion was hashed out over a long period of time with Representative Kiffmeyer in a bill that I ultimately carried in 2010. And you know, it worked out. It was a good system then, and I would suggest the same thing as we look at bills like this to gain bipartisan support. Instead of trying to kind of swap issues or trade off different things, spend some time together to actually have a discussion about it, without doing it in the middle of a committee room, and see where we can agree, where we can take out things we just totally disagree with, and move forward with that. And it was a pretty good system for finding bipartisan compromise. And one of the results of that is that we managed to figure out a way to go from signatures to numbers without upsetting the whole bill by getting to a debate about photo ID. So I think if we could continue on that path, we might actually get something done this session.
Thank you. Are there additional comments or questions this time? It sounds like the committee is interested in laying this bill over and taking a look at it when we get our next committee engrossment and looking at how amendments might fit in at that point if the author is amenable to that. Very good. With that, I will go ahead and lay the bill over, and I believe we can adjourn. And Representative Simon.
Though I'm not sitting in the chair, if I were, I would say that we will be having a hearing on Tuesday. You'll get ample notice about it. I'm not sure whether we'll take this bill up again on Tuesday. We might not. It may need more airing out, and it may need some more thoughtful input from all members about things they like and things they don't, both offline and on. I think Representative Winkler's comment is good. We have to be careful, though. We do have an open meeting requirement. We can't just all meet in a room in private and hash these things out, but I think there are subsets of us that can talk, and we should do as much as we can publicly as well. But so that's the plan for Tuesday. Other bills, probably.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Simon. So we've laid the bill over, and now we can adjourn. Thank you.